Brad Cohen. I'm director of the Duvalier Institute for Emergency Preparedness, which is a training institute within the Boston Public Health Commission and Boston EMS. And I'm co-presenting with Peter Hultgrave, who is the director of the Boston Area Health Education Center, which is also a program of the Boston Public Health Commission. One of the functions of BAHEC, as we call the Boston Area Health Education Center, is training of medical interpreters. And so our two programs partnered together to create a specialization course for medical interpreters who had already been trained in their basic skills through BAHEC's program so that they could be conversant in emergency preparedness and participate during an activation. So what we're going to do is talk about that course. And we're going to start with Peter, who's going to give some background about medical interpretation.
Thanks, Brad. Good evening, everyone. Just to do another quick survey, how many of you in this room are actual medical interpreters? How many of you are bilingual or multicultural? Okay. Welcome. The need for medical, and what I first want to accent from Brad's opening remarks are, even though the title of this presentation talks about the need for language interpreters, we, like he was saying, we specialize in medical interpreters. So even though in an emergency response, those with bilingual or multilingual skills might be called and could be trained in what we're talking about, specifically the cohort of individuals that we provided this specialized pilot training with were medical interpreters. So they have the specialized training of knowing the anatomy and physiology. They are versed in the standards of ethics of code of interpreting and so forth, which I'll also talk about later in the presentation. But why do we need interpreters and medical interpreters in particular for emergency response or disaster response? Well, it's because the face of the people that we serve are predominantly multicultural, multilingual, and many of them have varying degrees of English proficiency. So whether it's the 2000 census, which says that close to half of us will be people of color, or in Massachusetts, where our population is that we serve, predominantly we're looking at Spanish-speaking populations followed by those who come from Pacific Rim countries, with many of them, one in five, being of Brazilian descent. The immigrant face of the United States is certainly is growing exponentially over time. So we can see about a 4% increase over the past 27 years in Massachusetts. That's quite a bit larger than nationally, which is about 17%. In Washington, D.C., it's 27%. California, it's 29%. So these numbers keep rising, so the people we need to serve keep shifting at the same time. Why do we need them as well? It's because, well, you can't really communicate with someone else if you don't know their language, if you don't know their cultural background, obviously, and if it's not culturally sensitive and appropriate. So class, this necessity for culturally and linguistic appropriate services, it should be a backbone to any kind of public health service, but in particular, it should be a necessity and should be part of any public health plan during a emergency response or disaster response. And the main things I just want to highlight from this are that we focus at the Boston Public Health Commission and focus on and try to mitigate the effects of health disparities. That if we design emergency response programs that are not considerate of language and culture, we're not reaching our populations. And since the banner theme of our panel today is Katrina, one of the highlighted additional layers of tragedy in terms of emergency and public health response was the lack of multilingual services to tell people how to get out of the city, when to get out of the city, how to receive essential services, whether it was at the Superdome or otherwise. And of course, what Brad will talk about in a few moments is if you're going to implement any kind of an incident command system, prerequisite to that is your population needs to understand what you're talking about. If you're going to direct them to a decon tent, for example, they don't know what you're talking about, or if you're using a vocabulary where they might understand but it might have multiple meanings in their language and you don't know the cultural context, then the degree and the potential for disservice and risk to those people, I think commonsensically, is quite high. And of course, there's a lot of legal mandates, both national, I won't read through all those, and local, most of them through emergency rooms, but this is not mandated at the community health center level, and it's certainly not mandated in most emergency preparedness plans at the local, state, and national levels, unfortunately. And just to give you a further characterization of our population that we serve, we serve over 112 different languages in a pretty small state, and we're only talking about the Boston metro area, most of them substantially being Spanish-speaking, but that is changing over time with a lot of African country languages being more represented by the year. Whoops. Go the other way there. And so what is their role in emergency response? For those of you that have kind of a background or awareness of the role of medical interpreters, this is a quick review. But essentially, we need these individuals to provide assistance to families and first responders or providers. And a lot of folks don't know that in addition to legal interpreters, medical interpreters in particular have a very rigid code of ethics of what their role is. I want to emphasize that in this ideal scenario of planning, it's a triadic relationship where you have a patient or a client who's affected by a disaster in some capacity, you have the provider or first responder who's relaying the information, and then the role of the interpreter is the one who's relaying that information between those two parties as exactly and as accurately as possible. And there's a national code of ethics by which they are trained by. There is no national certification for medical interpreters. There's only a handful of states that have state-level certification, Washington State being one of them. Massachusetts is on that roadway, so those of you who have ever heard of the International Medical Interpreter Association, that's one of their charges in trying to lead that fight, if you will, to statewide, if not nationwide, standardize the role of medical interpreters in their training. I also want to emphasize that they do not provide medical assistance. Again, their role is to just interpret what another professional, whether it's a medical professional, a public health professional, or emergency responder is saying. And these are the four typical roles of an interpreter. And the pyramid is not in terms of a hierarchy of importance, but just in the amount of time. So first and foremost, they serve as a conduit, and I'll go through defining these quickly shortly. They serve as a clarifier, then a cultural broker, and then as needed, an advocate based upon the situation within an emergency context. So as a conduit, this is the most fundamental role of how medical interpreters are trained. They're well-versed in this context, ideally, in emergency response and procedures. They have a thorough background in medical terminology and anatomy and physiology. So if there's a physician on site or a nurse practitioner or an EMT who's relaying instructions to a patient or a client, they understand what's going on or know when to kind of do a check-in to clarify the situation. So it's rendering exactly what's being told. So they're interpreting, but they're trying to do it as precisely as possible so that they don't assume the liability role of taking it upon themselves to interpret, say, what a physician is saying at a hazmat site that could lead to a misinterpretation and put the patient or client into jeopardy. As clarifier, at any point, these professionals are trained to see if they perceive that the patient does not understand what's going on, if they don't understand the terminology that they've just interpreted directly from the responder or the health provider, then it's their responsibility to kind of act as a broker between the provider in that triadic relationship with the patient or client to make sure that that's a, do you understand me? Do you want to read back to me what we're talking about? Now, of course, in an emergency situation, time is of the essence, so this could be compromised, but this is one of their roles if they perceive there's a fundamental misunderstanding between the service provider and the client. And then cultural broker. The terminology, even emergency response, has different meanings in different cultures, that if you exactly translate different phrases in the jargon that we all employ in emergency response and public health, it could have completely different meaning in some other cultural context. So ideally, the medical interpreters that should be enlisted should represent and mirror the population that would be most affected by an emergency response so that they can understand the different gradations of interpretation between, say, Portuguese versus Spanish versus Cape Verdean, et cetera. And then as advocate, if they believe that the person that they're interpreting for is in jeopardy, that their lives are in danger or their health could be compromised because of the transaction that is occurring between the provider, responder, and the patient, they're really there to make sure that they're an advocate for that individual. Now, in the role of emergency response, this does not mean that they subsume responsibility for the provider. It just means that they should be able to make sure that they're combating all the isms and all the cultural barriers that prevent adequate health care and proper communication in emergency response that would jeopardize someone's life. Now, in terms of the two traditional modes of interpreting, we're really talking about consecutive when we're talking about emergency response. Simultaneous, the best analogy I can make is a UN interpreter, which is a very high level of training of being able to have someone just rattle on in English, for example, and then be able to interpret simultaneously to the person that's in front of them. Because we're talking about brief communication, as accurate as possible, directions, for example, it's something in which the provider or the first responder would communicate There's a pause, the interpreter relates the information to the client, and then questions are asked. So there's no simultaneous nature to that. It's necessarily consecutive to minimize confusion and misunderstanding. So what are the benefits of having these folks here? I think beyond the commonsensical, which is if the folks you're serving don't understand what you're talking about, it's all just follow the leader, the potential for misdiagnosis, the potential for jeopardy is quite high. So again, it's their role is to enhance and enable the communication in that triadic relationship between the provider and the responder and the client and patient. It's to make sure, especially in a medical treatment situation where someone might have a different medical condition where receiving an inoculation might put that person in jeopardy, for example, that the medical interpreter has to have some background and understanding what that diagnosis represents to be able to clarify, again, in that role what that situation is. And to really, that's kind of the key to this whole slide, is preventing misdiagnosis, mistreatment, miscommunication that could lead to ill effects and outcomes. And, of course, you know, from a legal standpoint, a health standpoint, that's there. It also reduces costs. There's several different studies that are done both within a hospital context and ER, community health centers, but not really done in emergency context or training, that it greatly reduces costs. You know, obviously you don't need to go back to correct a botched operation or an emergency care response if the communication understanding is much more accurate than just making an assumption that could lead to an improper interaction. And you'll see an exception is the PPE costs, and I'll get back to that a little bit later. And now to talk about the different disasters that these medical interpreters play an integral role in, I'm going to turn it back to Brad.
Thanks. Just to keep moving, what I'll say here is that we want to create opportunities and methods for interpreters to be active in response to any kind of situation. Looking at terrorist attacks in particular, but also somewhat relating to other kinds of disasters. With terrorism, the objective is to produce fear. And so, of course, fear, when people are afraid, they're less able to communicate because of their anxiety, and so the ability to communicate effectively becomes all the more important. We also know that victims become hypersensitive to their symptoms, and so the ability to really accurately do medical interviewing with victims becomes much more important. There are other psychological requirements which come to the forefront as well, the real need to know the condition and location of family members and the large number of worried well. These are just confounding factors making the need for interpretation all the more important. So this is a brief overview, and I'll just talk about some of the points of the course that we put together. We put together a four-day, ran over four sessions course. We had 81 people register or ask to be in the course representing 17 languages. We had 20 spots. We expanded that to 22 spots. Remember, our target audience was medical interpreters who had already been trained through BAHEC or a similar program. And so those we settled on the five interpreters within the five languages of Portuguese, Chinese, Haitian Creole, Cape Verdean, and Spanish. What that took was that we wanted to have more than one, preferably three or four students speaking each language so that they could work together. We also had language consultants who worked specifically with them in the particular language, in addition to instructors both from the medical interpreter side and the emergency preparedness side as well. So it was a very instructor intensive course to put on. Just a few things that I'll call out from the actual course sessions, we started with an overview about potential disasters that they might be called in for, the kinds of hospital responses, an introduction to PPE that they might be asked to use. We introduced them to the incident command system so that they would understand the context in which they'd be asked to work. We went through two scenarios with them. The first in session two was the mass dispensing clinic, and then later on in session four we did a mass decontamination scenario as well. We also provided them with the two national courses, IS 100 and 700, Introduction to Incident Command and NIMS. and allowed them to take those federal courses so that they would have those under their belt as well. And each session we finished up with a debriefing, which was a real an opportunity for intensive dialogue about both the language issues and the cultural issues that were coming up. What I'm going to do is focus on just a couple of those topics, the ICS, the mass dispensing clinic, and the decontamination. So we gave them an introduction to incident command system. You're probably familiar with this. We focused their work on operations because it's within the operations section that the delivery of services takes place with clients, patients, or victims. This is a breakdown, breakout of the operations section the way we usually see it in Boston for public health emergencies. So there's risk communication, communicable disease, environmental health, emergency medical response, and human services, any of which, some or all of which might be activated in an emergency. We developed a job action sheet, and I'll just highlight some parts of that job action sheet for you. We defined the medical interpreter as someone who has previous training, who works within a code of professional ethics, and who provides interpreter services within that triadic relationship that Peter talked about. The immediate responsibilities are pretty typical of a job action sheet. If you're familiar with those, you accept the assignment, you read the whole job action sheet, and you get a briefing from whoever it is that you'll be reporting to. And then the ongoing responsibilities are exactly the roles of the medical interpreter that Peter described, being a conduit, a clarifier, the cultural broker, or an advocate. We wanted to include these not only to remind the medical interpreter of what their role is, but that is their primary job, but also so that the person who they're reporting to, who may not be used to working with medical interpreters, can have a quick reference. Thanks. And then we also will involve them in the demobilization. So the mass dispensing clinic scenario, this is just a basic layout. We actually set up a clinic for them. We had additional students come in to role play, people coming through the clinic in various languages. Off to the right, there's a typical sort of interview sheet that people coming into a clinic might be asked, and you can see there's a lot of words on it, so it could be pretty intimidating if it's in English and you're not used to English. These are just some pictures from an actual activation. Turning to mass decontamination, the purpose of mass decontamination is to get stuff off of you, off your clothes, off your skin, and as well as to protect the people who are working there and to provide psychological comfort. So it's really important to have to build instant relationship with everyone who's coming through, and language and culture can be a barrier to that. Some of the principles that come into play, you need to do it quickly. You're asking people to remove their clothes and lots of water. The water may not be hot even on a cold day. So you can imagine that raises lots of issues with people not being particularly happy to be there. And so communication is all the more important. These are some photographs of our students from the medical interpreter class learning to don level C PPE, and we set up a decontamination tent like they would see in a typical Boston hospital so that they could get familiar with that environment. We have about a half a minute.
So in my remaining 30 seconds, I do have copies of all of our slides up here at the table if you'd like to take them with our contact information. But some lessons we learned just as providers, and we're going to be providing this training, I think, on an annual basis, it was quite successful, is just to emphasize the need of including medical interpreters in any disaster emergency response. And that the issue is that, of course, you need to protect the providers or the first responders. But if you're a medical interpreter, you need to be able to communicate. So the PPE, in addition to protecting you biologically or physically, is also a barrier to communication. You can't really communicate with this big hazmat mask on. And this is where the more prohibitive cost comes in, that if you want to buy a PPE outfit or a hazmat outfit that has a speaker microphone attached to it, I don't know many hospitals, including MGH, that even invests in that level of being able to communicate between in that triadic relationship. So that's a challenge that we need to throw out there and think about more thoroughly. Also, this issue of advocacy, of when does the medical interpreter kind of say, I'm no longer interpreting, I'm now going to help this person. We all have this natural inclination to do so, but the code of ethics forbids it unless there's certain parameters. Those parameters are not defined. So the question that always that came up from a lot of our students is, when do we do X, Y, and Z? When do I play a stronger role, not being just the conduit or the clarifier or the cultural broker, but I'm playing a stronger role in ensuring this person's safety and health? Those ethical standards need to be defined, we believe, by the emergency organization that you're working with. So in our case, it would be the emergency responders at the City of Boston. So whether it's it's the American Red Cross or what have you, there's an absence of standards to talk about specifically when do they shift roles, what is appropriate given their national code of ethics within the environment of emergency response. We need to emphasize that it's really important that it remain to be a triadic role, that it's not just you take someone who's multicultural, you stick them in front of the hazmat tent, and you tell the people who speak your target language what's happening. Because, again, unless you understand the terminology involved, unless you're properly trained, if you don't know the cultural context, et cetera, again, the types of errors can magnify that I think are just assumed, even in an emergency room context. And, of course, the absence of literature in multiple languages, whether it's Katrina, whether it's hepatitis A in Boston. We often have first response that's targeted most of our resources toward English only, and we think that's a problem. There are many EP concepts that that have no meaning in other languages. So even saying incident command system to the average person on the street, they have no idea. So take that into other languages, and you can kind of see and appreciate the level of possible misinterpretation, misunderstanding, and anxiety that's associated with that. And of course, we would advocate having trainings like this to be standard for all emergency responders. Just want to throw this in that if you look at the color red, we all associate that with danger. It could mean different things in different cultural contexts, and of course, there's several other analogies. Does anyone have any questions? Yes. Now, those are actual four standard roles that all medical interpreters are trained in. So they learn to distinguish between those four, beginning as a conduit, there's misunderstanding of the go-to clarifier, et cetera. And I think the main purpose for the job action sheet, for the reason why Brad included that, is because many non-medical interpreters, providers of emergency care, don't know what the role of medical interpreters are. Or it might be at the incident commander level, for example, or someone else within that chain. But if there's others that are first responders and they don't understand why is this interpreter here, it becomes a good quick footnote for them to kind of incorporate that. Now, if there was proper training of incorporating medical interpreters in an emergency response team, then I think that would be less necessary. But at this level of having an absence of, fully integrating medical interpreters into systems like this, we just saw it as a nice kind of crib sheet for those who are not fully versed as to what do medical interpreters do. Yes?
There's not a lot of it that's specific to Boston. We talk about some of the Boston plans, but it certainly could be generic, and we'd be happy to make ours available to it. We haven't found a lot that's similar to this in other places. If anyone's familiar with any, we would love to know about that. The Massachusetts Department of Public Health has started some planning on some similar work. We're collaborating with them. Yes.
I
think all of those are excellent questions, and I think that gets more to the point of that this needs to be more in the forefront of thinking and emergency planning, that ASL definitely is a part of this scenario. So when we talk about medical interpreters, having sign language interpreters who are also equally versed are very important. We also were discussing as kind of a post reflection on the training we've done now that there are a series of kind of codes or pictograms, if, as you call them, that emergency responders have, but they're not universally accepted and they're not universally understood and well known. So I think that kind of standardizing, to kind of get back to another presenter's perspective on making sure that we kind of standardize how we evaluate what's appropriate, I would hope that an interpreter service level or having an ability to communicate in multiple dimensions would be a part of that 33 points or whatever it was. And that sign language definitely needs to be a part of that. There are many facets to this. Are people with disabilities fully factored into this? And often I think they're more considered when like mass dispensing clinics are developed as opposed to, wait a minute, can we even talk to the people in the first place? Whether there are they have hearing issues or whether they are come from a different linguistic background. Did you add to that? And I'm sorry, I don't think I addressed your first question. Could you reiterate that again, please? It was about the fires in California?
Well,
did I get that?
There was a lot of need for interpreters.
Yeah, yeah. And I would say that medical interpreters are paid on average between $20 and $45 an hour. Legal interpreters are paid on average $60 to $80 an hour. One of the roles of the International Medical Interpreter Association is to try to legitimize the role of medical interpreters to be beyond, to challenge the conventional thinking, which you often find in an emergency room, which is, oh good, your mother's in trouble and you speak Spanish and English, you can interpret for me. And before you know it, there's some concept that the young person is trying to convey that could put that mother in jeopardy. Or you're asking a question to someone of, I'm just going to pick a culture, Haitian Creole descent. You're asking that person a very personal question, and they don't want to deliver any information. They just believe whatever the physician says goes. And if you have a medical interpreter that understands that, again, that cultural brokering role, it becomes integral. So we would like to see the role of medical interpreters elevated and better recognized, both from a public response, in not only in emergency rooms where it's mandated by law in Massachusetts, but also community health centers, and even those with special health care needs. If you're trying to coordinate services in the medical home context, for example, the need is much more expansive. I think it needs to be recognized, and there needs to be financial incentives to have these people available, whether it's an emergency or not.
Final question.
Thank you.
Thank you.